continue with business combinations under common control. I give the floor to Julia.
Thank you, Hans. I will make a quick introduction and then hand it over to Simona to introduce the papers for today's meeting. So just a reminder, in September, the board discussed when a current value approach based on the acquisition method and when a predecessor approach should be applied for transactions within the scope of the project. The board tentatively decided that, in principle, a current value approach based on the acquisition method should be applied to transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders in the receiving entity, subject to an exception and an exemption for privately held receiving entities. And the board decided that a predecessor approach should be applied to all other transactions within the scope of the project. At this meeting, we start a discussion of how a predecessor method should be applied. And just to remind you, so this is primarily designed for transactions between wholly owned entities. We ask the board for decisions on two topics: which carrying amounts for assets and liabilities a receiving entity should use, and which pre-combination information should be provided. At future meetings, we will discuss remaining questions related to how a predecessor approach should be applied. We will discuss how a current value approach should be applied, and specifically whether and how the acquisition method in IFRS 3 should be modified for transactions within the scope of the project. And we will discuss disclosure for business combinations under common control. And with that, I hand it over to Simona.
Yeah. Good afternoon, board members. Agenda paper 23A discusses which carrying amounts should be used by the receiving entity for assets and liabilities transferred in a BCCC when applying a predecessor approach. Paragraphs 6 to 22 summarize the findings in the staff's research and outreach.
In summary, we observed that some of the national GAAP required the use of the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of the controlling party. Those GAAPs view the transaction from the perspective of the controlling party. Other GAAPs require the use of the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of the transfer entities, and those GAAPs view the transaction from the perspective of the combining entities. The guidance published by accounting firms allows an accounting policy choice. We have also reviewed the current practice for applying a formal predecessor approach. Out of 251 transactions that we identified as reported applying a predecessor approach, from January 2018 to March 2019, in approximately half of the transactions, entity used the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of the controlling party. For about 10% of those transactions, entities used the carrying amounts reported by the transfer entities. In the remaining cases, the entities did not specify which carrying amounts were used. However, we also noted that in most cases, when national requirement exists, accounting policy choices made by the entities on predecessor carrying amounts were consistent with those requirements in the entities' jurisdictions. Based on our research, we have identified two alternatives.
We lost your introduction for 10 seconds or so. If that's a,
I think the world will survive.
Yeah. Okay.
Even though it was very eloquent, so, so it is a loss.
Okay. All right. Based on our research, we have identified two alternatives. The receiving entity should use the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of the transfer entities, alternative A, or the receiving entity should use the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of the controlling party, alternative B. We'd like to emphasize that both alternatives would result in the same outcome if the transfer entity has always been a part of the group. However, the outcome would be different if the transfer entity has been acquired from a third party. In that case, the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of the transfer entity and the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of its parent would be different. The staff think that the use of alternative A would reflect the perspective of the combining entities and be consistent with the reporting entity's perspective in the conceptual framework. And it would also be consistent with the idea of combined financial statements discussed in the conceptual framework. It would also support comparability with the historical financial information of the transfer entity and would help users to perform trend analysis. On the contrary, alternative B would reflect the perspective of the controlling party rather than the perspective of the combining entity, which is not consistent with the reporting entity concept in the conceptual framework. That alternative would be similar to the so-called push-down accounting, and we are not aware of any basis for applying push-down accounting under existing IFRS standards. In terms of information content, alternative B could deliver more recent values of the transferred assets and liabilities than alternative A. However, it would still not deliver current values of those assets and liabilities at the time of the BCOCC. Instead, the carrying amount used in alternative B would be based on fair values of the transfer entity as at the time that entity was acquired into the group from a third party. However, in some cases, the information provided by alternative B might still be more relevant for some users, especially if the external acquisition was recent. From a practical point of view, we think that both alternatives are operational. Staff's recommendation is included in paragraph 43, and for the reason I've just summarized, the staff recommend the forthcoming discussion paper proposes alternative A, specifically that the receiving entity should recognize and measure assets and liability transfer in a BCCC at the carrying amounts included in the financial statements of the transfer entities. And with that, I open the floor to discussion.
So I agree with the staff's recommendation. And I think it's useful also to remember that this question won't come up in a lot of situations, if not most situations, that we're only talking about circumstances where there was an acquisition by the ultimate controlling party at some point in time, sort of subsequent to the establishment of the subsidiary. So it's not like this is a question in all cases, and I think it's just useful to remember that. But I do agree with the staff recommendation for a couple of reasons. I think that the underlying reason why I agree with the staff recommendation is that I'm trying to stick as closely as possible to our normal concepts and principles and requirements, if you like. And so while I agree that there are circumstances where the predecessor method can make sense based on the decisions we've made so far, I think that if we're looking at the receiving entity's consolidated financial statements, for me there's only really two perspectives that could make sense to me, either the transferred entity's perspective or the receiving entity's perspective. To me, the controlling entity's perspective has sort of nothing to do with the consolidated financial statements at the level that we're looking at. And the thing I find particularly sort of troubling, in a sense, is those that argue that one of the reasons why they like the carrying amount of the controlling entity to be used is because it is a more up-to-date measure. But if you really care about up-to-date measures, I'd be using the acquisition approach. And so I'm not sure why a more up-to-date measure that's still not the acquisition date measure is suddenly relevant, sort of by definition. So I'd agree with your recommendation.
Gary.
Thank you. I agree with the staff's recommendation also, for a variety of reasons. But when I'm looking at paragraph 42, where it talks about alternative B would use a single set of records for the same entity within the group, I find that non-persuasive argument for B, because ultimately individual companies' records are kept in whatever way is convenient for the parent company. They may or may not be under IFRS, they might be under anything else, and once a year you create a set of IFRS statements. So I think that's a non-persuasive, argument why you would go for B. I like the answer for A for all the reasons that Sue expressed as well as in the paper. I think it's just easier. It really is that simple. And again, I appreciate that there's a lot of statutory reporting out there, but when it's a transaction between two wholly owned companies, I mean, in what way is the world better off by going to B or a more complicated way? And especially as you point out in here, it might not always be clear who the parent is, the intermediate parents and holding companies and everything else. So I think A is the only practical answer.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. I got different views. I disagree with staff's proposal. There are a couple of reasons I think why I think it's better to think about what's the meaning of the predecessor carrying amount. and when it should be start the starting point, whether the carry amounts should be the reflected in this financial statement or transfer entity, or should be start from when those transferred entity become the member of the group. That means the carry amount show on the consolidated financial statement and the controlling party. I think we should think about which carry amount can provide more useful information to the users. Because based on our decision I now made, predecessor method will mainly apply to those wholly owned entities. Well, that means who is the users? The users of the receiving entity. There are only one investor, that is controlling party. There's no NCI there. Secondly, maybe there are some creditors. For controlling party, at the controlling party's consolidated financial statement, for that controlling party, more relevant information actually comparing to the carry amount of the transferred entity. Actually, the cost the controlling party paid and allocated to all those assets and liabilities of transferred entity, I think more relevant to the controlling party. Particularly when controlling party evaluation performance of those acquired business, because that is the new cost for the controlling party. And when the controlling party evaluated the subsequent performance, normally were based on that new cost, new carrying amount, not based on the carrying amount of the transferred entity. That is very old carrying amount, not very relevant to the controlling party's decision and the performance valuation. So I think for creditors, they care about the value of the assets, liability, liquidity, risks. I think they have similar information needs with regard to these cases. So from users' needs, I do believe, as paragraph 40 said that, I think approach A really can provide more useful information, more timely information to the users comparing to the carry amount of transferred entity. So this is the first point. Second point, which approach could faithfully represent the nature of those transactions? I still think that this BCUCC, the nature of the BCUCC, actually is the transaction between owners. Because especially in these cases, there's only one owner. Whatever you issue shares or pay money, all those shares, main money, go to your single owner, parent. So this is the nature. So who care about? I think that owner really care about all the transactions. So not care about, because carrying amount of the transferred entity formed before they became the member of the group. So I think we should think about that, really, which amount really relevant to the nature of the BCUCC. And thirdly, based on the current practice, I think we did a very good job to did a survey, and I noticed that actually by now, if we look at the current practice, there is only about 10% of the companies actually applying this kind of approach. And there is about 50% clearly those BCUCC are using the predecessor carrying amount. That carrying amount is the carrying amount of the reflected in the consolidated financial statements or controlling party. I think there is actually confirmed that most of cases there is information needs, because if you look at those 50% of the companies, actually their users, I think they're happy with this kind of result. If we decide to change that, that means those companies, they have to change the accounting policy, and those updated fair value information cannot be available for them. I think that is a very significant loss of the useful information for those users. So based on those observations, I prefer approach A rather than approach B.
Thank you. I agree with Jin Chao's suggestion. I'd like to suggest to you to add analysis on their, what kind of information we are providing when you apply the carrying amount of transferred entity. So the, as Jin Chao said, who is our primary user of this information? So the, you did an excellent job and you considered the case of the some entity with the NCS. So you just repeated that all kind of a judgment in a criterion is whether this information is useful or not. But unfortunately, that kind of analysis is not here. So that's why maybe Jin Chao is suggesting if their primary user in this case is the principal in a, the controlling party of the parent, then that's the only one in a existing investor in this case. There are no NCSs. So they are what this parent, ultimate controlling party, would like to have. So in that sense, maybe the US GAAP and some others might think maybe the more useful information is maybe based on carrying amounts of the ultimate parents, that kind of a scenario. So please add that kind of analysis to this nice written paper. Another thing is, it's a little more technical thing, is that the perspective of entity and the owners in the conceptual framework, paragraph 3.8, you used this kind of paragraph for your justification of the approach B. It seems to me that this paragraph might be, seems to me, directly related to this issue rather than, paragraph 3.8 is related to you should account for every transaction from the perspective of an entity, not just a private of individuals perspective. That is a kind of purpose of this paragraph 3.8, but in this case, it's a kind of a quite different situation. Because if we acknowledge the kind of something under common control concept, then it's quite different from the setting the paragraph 3.8 conceptual framework sits and the logical conceptual analysis for this case. So that's the a kind of a technical advice to think about the kind of applicability of the paragraph 3.8. So, but if we suggest a kind of practical reason, you know, this is much more convenient while using the carrying amount to transferred entity, then it's okay. But others seems to me, why the other countries are using the carrying amount to transfer the parent rather than the transferred entity. So they may have some kind of justification. That's why I think, you know, an approach there what A or B, you know, maybe there are transferred entity. Anyway, the perspective might need be reconsidered. Thanks.
Councilor Azza.
Well, I don't have strong views on this. I could go with the recommendation without modification, so support it as written. I agree with the arguments which are given as it being, you know, more in line with our basic concepts and everything. If I'm undecided, though, it's because I don't see any argument that rests with the how useful the information is, because the differences lie in history and basically in the context of cost accounting. So I don't think that that makes any difference, in fact, from the quality of information. I would not go to the
values in the consolidated accounts without modification, I would take away goodwill. And that's the modification I would make. So basically, I can go with the majority, provided that if it goes for the consolidated accounts, it's without goodwill. And I would want to really dig into the issue of whether there is a difference in cost for the entities. Gary gave his view as saying that it doesn't make any difference. I'm not sure it necessarily is the case. It might be the case. So that's the kind of information that could make me go a particular direction rather than another. I would go with the majority, I think. And it won't be imposed on me.
I think I maybe a bit more like Francoise in terms of not feeling that strongly. I guess I come from a background of having watched Pushdown be debated in a U.S. setting for 35 years without a clear conclusion that that it does or doesn't give better information overall. So I think we just have to pick one and, give people the arguments, pro and con, so I don't object to the staff recommendation. I did have a few things I wanted to suggest that we bring out the reasons. Sue had identified some specific reasons, both she and Gary, both conceptual and practical, I think, for the approach. I think a couple of other things that struck me as I was thinking about the choice and how well things match up. I think you could argue that if the defining characteristic of this class of transactions is that they are under common control, that nature of being under common control is the most important feature, which I think would push for the kind of carrying value in the in the controlled group rather than the carrying value in the books of the acquisition. On the other hand, I'm not sure if it's a logical inconsistency or just an irony that if we are looking at the predecessor basis for this group because we have concluded that the application of acquisition accounting is at least not cost beneficial, if not, and at least some believe not relevant. So it would be ironic if we then did the alternative B, because the reason for the difference in carrying value would largely be acquisition accounting, for the acquisition of the group. So we'd be, taking the group's acquisition accounting and reflecting it while we weren't applying acquisition accounting, for the transaction at hand. So I think those are just reasons I'd like to see covered off in terms of pros and cons considered by the board. I do a couple of cautions that I'd offer and things that maybe should be de-emphasized in the any consultation paper. You characterized in paragraph 21 the regulators as having a more consistent view, but I noticed it looks in the paragraph 19 that you only talked with a single set of regulators from one region, and given that we saw geographic diversity, and some geographic tendencies around this issue, I don't think we can say that reads across all regulators. It just happens to be the regulators from one group. And the other is that when you were analyzing, if we did go alternative B, what B would kind of automatically incorporate in terms of reliefs if certain information wasn't available. I don't know that we'd grant all the reliefs that you started to sketch out as approach B. If we thought that the carrying value in the controlling parties was the relevant information, I don't know that we'd say only if it was available, and if not, you default to this, and if not, you default to that, and maybe you can't do it. I think we'd have to think hard if we thought that was what we wanted somebody to be doing. So I wouldn't say that it's that package. I think the we'd be consulting on the concept of what is the information and what is your objective. I can see that there are circumstances in which we'd have to try and answer those practical questions, but I'm not sure that that's how we'd answer them or how far we'd go. So I'd say focus it back on the question of, which is the choice of approach we're making.
Tadeo.
I support the staff's position. I just draw attention to the fact that depending on who is the part who is transferring the subsidiary, it might make a difference. I mean, that if it is your sister transferring the company, I think that makes sense, bringing everything, not just the historical amount, but also the goodwill, the step up that sparked it at the sister. But if it is the parent company, not the ultimate one, the parent company that has the investment, it's just transferring from one sister. It's not the subsidiary is parked here. I'm just transferring to this one, and I don't lose the information, because otherwise, if you keep the amount, if you just transfer the historical amount from your sister, what would you do with the numbers that are parked in this company here? I mean, that you don't have the subsidiary anymore. And that's why I believe that if you are in a level above, makes sense bringing the historic amount. But if you are just beside, makes sense bringing all the amounts. But one thing that really is a strong argument for me, at least, using the carrying amounts, is the risk of having the push-down accounting in this type of transaction. And that's otherwise, it's very easy if you don't do this approach. A, it's A, isn't it? Yeah. If I don't go for alternative A, it's very easy to do the push down using the alternative B. And then, therefore, if we have a strong view from other people's from alternative B, the next phase, I would look at the solution to avoid the push-down accounting. But so far, I think that it's the easiest way to go on this type of transaction is just using the carrying amount. That's alternative A.
Martin?
And I agree also with staff recommendation. And I also don't buy the arguments that we should look at the primary user as a parent, a controlling party, because I think if that would be, I think we should maybe make a rule that this company don't have to produce consolidated accounts because the controlling party has already all the kind of information and there is no need to produce combined accounts, I think, for the parent company. Secondly, I think it is, if we would use the carrying amounts of the, which is consolidated in the parent companies, what would we do if the parent company uses US GAAP? And then the combining entity has to use IFRS. Would you use the US GAAP amounts then? Is that then what you do? Or would you then require then the company to do first in business combination then for IFRS? I think it is all complicated. And therefore, I agree with staff recommendation and would do the carrying amounts historical for this separate company.
So just building on that, I agree from our perspective the primary user isn't the controlling shareholder, but it's the lenders and other creditors. The primary, the controlling shareholder get all the information they need. And we've done some research into that area already, and it kind of builds on the sentiment expressed in paragraph 21 in the last point there when a regulator said, it's debatable which approach could provide the most useful information to the users of financial statements. And I think that was our conclusion when we looked, first of all, at whether we should be using the current or predecessor approach under these circumstances. So I guess I just have a couple of follow-up questions for the team. You said that 50%, or the survey suggested 50% of transactions used the amounts in the controlling entities' books. Is that largely driven by regulation? It is. Okay. So it's not a choice, but the entity's been...
No, it's a choice. It depends about the geographical pattern, because if an entity is located, for example, in a country where local GAAPs require, for example, pushing down the carrying amounts from the consolidating party perspective, so they apply IS-8, and basically they base their own policy based on what is recommended by national GAAP. So it's a choice, but is influenced by the region where the entity is located.
Okay. And do we have any information whether there are any cost differences between which information is provided? Is both sets of information readily available?
We haven't researched specifically into costs of as the approach, and this is something we can do as part of the consultation on the discussion paper, but sort of from the from the common sense perspective, it seems that if, for example, the transferred entity prepares IFRS financial statements, the numbers are there.
Okay. So I think it is quite balanced, but I think kind of intuitively and conceptually I come down in line with the staff's recommendation here, but I think it's important to acknowledge it is quite finely balanced.
General?
Thank you. Just I wonder, you know, if we accept the kind of perspective of a receiving entity, then why do we use carrying amount approach? Why don't you use the current value approach? If the regulator is the primary user of this kind of information, then the regulator would like to have a more current value rather than carrying amount of the transferred entity. So if we just have that kind of perspective of the receiving entity, forget the parents or everything because they have all kind of information, in that case, you know, maybe we can go to the same conclusion as before in the case of NCSS. So why not go to that approach of the current value approach rather than carrying amount approach here?
Too expensive.
Sue?
I was just going to make a point in this, why when I started off initially I made the point that this is only sort of relevant if you've got an external acquisition, not a sort of internally created subsidiary, if you like. In one jurisdiction where I talked to them about the strength of a feeling on the predecessor approach, where I know that they use the alternative approach B in their jurisdiction, I asked them how important the fact was that if we accepted the predecessor approach, it was the approach B type of predecessor approach, or were they going to be unhappy if we went with the predecessor approach with a variation from what they were used to. And the reason why I made my comment was that they said it wasn't such a big deal to them because it was pretty uncommon that those subsidiaries had been purchased. So I think that's worth thinking about. It's not a direct answer to Nick's cost question, but I don't think it's all, you know, it's going to be that often the case that people are going to have this distinction anyway. And I think that's worth thinking of. And I think the reason why I prefer approach A is that, on the subject of principles versus rules, I always find it easier if I've got a few anchors that I can understand and I can cling on to, and I can understand, you know, thinking about the reporting entity's perspective. And once I sort of set aside all of those normal rules and start to say, okay, no, now I'm going to accept this controlling party's view and all of these things, I feel like I'm losing my own little conceptual framework that I've got to work with. And that's why I think that it's helpful for me, at least, if we can stick as closely as we can to the bits of the conceptual framework that we can still use, even if we've accepted the predecessor approach, which wouldn't necessarily be our sort of natural starting position. And if I understand, if I remember correctly, given the scope and the decisions we've made so far, there will be potential third-party primary users, in our view, that would be using these financial statements. So, for example, lenders.
Yeah. Yeah?
It's not just the controlling party that we're talking about, right?
Yeah. And the other group of users that we should keep in mind is obviously potential equity investors, for example, in an IPO scenario. And I probably made this point earlier already, but what we've heard a few times in the outreach, that in an IPO scenario, it is quite important that there is a consistent basis for all assets and liabilities going for an IPO. So under alternative A, we take, if you will, combined financial statements perspective. So we take carrying amounts of the receiving entity, carrying amounts of the transferred entities. So it's a combined financial statement. Whereas once we start using carrying amounts from the controlling party level, then for the combined entity, it's no longer combined accounts. It's a mix and match of different values.
Jen Chao.
Yeah, I think something is still puzzle me, because what's the users who are the users of those financial statements and what their information needs. I think Nick asked a very good question, because currently at least there are 50% of the companies are using the approach B to account for those business. And I think we needed to do a little bit further research what those investors need with regard to those 50% of those risk companies. And I think maybe some jurisdictions, there are regulations there, there are national standards there, and there maybe a company just automatically chose this kind of approach. But there is a reason behind that. I think one of the reasons they try to meet the information needs of I will not say investors, because the maybe other users. So I think we should be aware of that and then make sure which approach we should support. Otherwise, it will be a significant change for those companies. So this is the first point. Second, I always think that we should not ignore or forget this is BCUCC. This is a transaction on the common control. We should not ignore controlling party. This is the transaction on the common control. If it's not on the control, no problem. We just go to using IFI3 because it's on the common control. So let's step back. What's the meaning of the processor method? Processor method means processor agreement should start from those business become the member or become a part of the group, become controlled by the controlling party. That is the processor carrying amount started. Otherwise, we cannot say this is the processor approach, because the carrying amount actually formed between the transferred entity and third parties, not the parties within the group. So I still think that we should not ignore the controlling party, and should not ignore the nature of the BCUCC. And thirdly, I think we also should not ignore the reasons of those accounting firms why they support this approach. I think we did a very good research, but the reason given in the paragraph 14, there are three reasons. I think all relevant to look at the nature of the BCUCC and develop those accounting approach for those transactions. I think this is exactly the approach accounting firms they are doing. They did.
I would like to comment on the outcome of our research of transactions, because I think it's quite important that we don't misinterpret the results of that research. So first of all, I'd like to highlight that in almost half of the cases, the information included in the financial statements was sort of inconclusive. We were not able to determine, at least based on our review so far, which carrying amounts they used. So I'd like to be careful and not sort of represent it as if the majority is using one particular approach. Second of all, I'd like also, with regard to this research, I'd like to emphasize that there is a very strong correlation between where an entity is located and which carrying amounts this entity chooses to use. So I think it's not unreasonable to conclude that the reason they're using a particular approach is not because each entity performs an analysis of what information is most useful to users, but rather the accounting choice is driven by the requirements in their jurisdiction. So if their local requirements tell them to take carrying amounts from the controlling party, this is what they do. So I'd like us to be really clear on that point as well. And then, Chin Chow, on your point about what is meant by predecessor carrying amounts, well, as we know, predecessor method is not defined anywhere, and it's not described. And in some jurisdictions, predecessor carrying amounts mean looking at the controlling party, but then in some other jurisdiction, predecessor means transferred entity. So just the sort of the fact that the board decided to use this method, it does not mean defaulting to the controlling party perspective. And I think it's quite important to keep that in mind as well.
Can I ask a question further? If when the controlling party acquired that business from the third party, and that group also using push-down accounting at that time. So that means the carry amount of the transferred business already changed because they using the push-down accounting. So based on our approach, do they need to go back to using the previous carry amount, or they can automatically using the new, you know, carry amount because they have already using the push-down accounting?
But we are talking, would you like to?
No, yeah, you mean applying push-down accounting in IFRS?
Because that business acquired from third parties at the first date. So, and then they using the push-down accounting at that date.
It's not IFRS push-down.
Exactly.
No, I just presume because we are silent on this approach, but if some companies already using the push-down accounting. If there is a case here, which carry amount?
We are talking about IFRS numbers, and under IFRS, an entity cannot apply push-down accounting.
Gary?
Just listening to this, a few more thoughts, and again, just remind you, I support the staff's recommendation. First of all, I think when the scope of the transactions we're talking with, which is 100% owned subsidiaries being moved around within a larger controlled group, I think, broadly speaking, I think we got to sit there and say, what is the true utility of these financial statements? And I personally think it's limited. I've been no secret about that. But I was involved in this a fair amount over time. And first of all, when there is a consequential borrowing, not just normal day-to-day trading, is wholly owned subsidiaries don't tend to borrow solely on their own. With some sort of parent or senior entity in the organization's backup facility or guarantees or representations or something. So I think material amounts of borrowing just typically does not exist in a vacuum. There's the parent company one way or the other is behind it. Two, I also found in my experience was that when you are talking to banks or other sort of lenders or people who might underwrite derivatives for you, they actually care more about stringing your numbers as the operation operates day to day, not with push down accounting or other stuff sitting in the corporate or further upstream, but how do you buy and sell and trade daily is more relevant. And that's what your operational cash flows are in that subsidiary. And three, a couple of times, micro including once back, and it's still in public accounting, push down accounting is a lot. There's more involved than just say, let's do push down accounting, because then I think we're going to have to define what is push down accounting and develop it and build it out, including items sitting in the parent company books that they deliberately don't push down to subsidiaries, but for a complete, full, and standalone set of statements, maybe they should be. So I don't think it's easy to say do push down accounting. I think we have to develop that thought, and I think that there's not a lot of developed thought on the world how to operationalize that, because it's not all that common. I think I don't know that we need to go that way.
Tom?
I'll let them come to a vote.
I think I support staff thing, and I think one of the, in paper 23, we say that you talked about a forthcoming discussion paper, although that's not certain. And I think I support the staff for the following reason, although I'm really conscious of what Jin Chao said. There's some whys. Why are the 50% doing what they're doing? Why do some regulators seem to want this? And the whys are not fully. We just sort of have a sense of what the why might be. But because it's a discussion paper, I think it would be good to have coherent positions going back to what Sue said. And I think if we put out coherent positions, the staff's is the more coherent position. How we would write it up, though, then becomes very important. It's a little bit analogous to the goodwill situation. Do we write a very balanced thing and try and understand all these whys better? So I support the staff position, but acknowledge that we're probably operating on incomplete knowledge, and that we should kind of write it with I think we get better results if we have a clear, coherent thing, but that we listen carefully and we write a more balanced discussion paper just to take into account some of the issues people have raised.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
11, one absent.
Bonnie, you continue?
Yeah. Now we move to agenda paper 23B that discusses precombination information when applying a predecessor approach. Paragraph 6022 summarized the findings in the staff's research and outreach. In summary, we observed that many of the national gap that we reviewed require precombination information for all combining entities, as if the combination occurred at the beginning of the earliest period presented. These gaps typically view the transaction from the perspective of the controlling party. However, the staff also identified instances when a formal predecessor approach is applied prospectively from the date of the transaction. The guidance published by accounting firms allows an accounting policy choice between presenting precombination information just for the receiving entity or for all combining entities as if they had always been combined. We have also reviewed the current practice for presenting precombination information applying a form of predecessor approach. Of 251 transactions, precombination information for all combining entities was provided for 198 transactions. Prospective accounting was applied to 44 transactions. As I mentioned earlier, we observed that in most cases, when national requirements or guidance exist, accounting policy choices made by entities were consistent with those requirements and guidance in the entity's jurisdictions. The topic has also been discussed at the June 2019 joint CIMAC and GPF meeting and at the July 2019 ASAF meeting. Although CIMAC and GPF members generally consider precombination information useful, the majority of the members express their preference for prospective accounting in the receiving entity's primary financial statements and providing precombination information for all combining entities in the notes of the financial statements. ASAF members who commented on the topic also share that view. Based on our research, we have identified two alternatives. Precombination information in the primary financial statement is provided for all combining entities or businesses as if they had always been combined. This is alternative A. And precombination information in primary financial statements is provided only for the receiving entity, alternative B. The staff think that requiring precombination information for all combining entities or businesses, alternative A, would arguably be conceptually consistent with the idea that transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity are not acquisition like those addressed by IFRS 3. This alternative would view precombination information as combined information. The concept of combined financial statement is discussed in the conceptual framework. And it would also provide information that is useful in analyzing trends. However, at the same time, the staff note that most stakeholders in our outreach activities do not support retrospective presentation of the transaction in primary financial statements because it would provide a picture of a group that did not exist in the past. In addition, we note that in some cases, providing for all combining entities precombination information that possesses the qualitative characteristics of useful financial information could be impracticable, for example, in a carve-out scenario. Staff's recommendation is included in paragraph 38, and on balance, the staff recommend that the forthcoming discussion paper should set out the preliminary view that applying a predecessor approach, precombination information in the primary financial statements is provided only for the receiving entity. The staff note that such an approach would be also consistent with the requirements of IFRS 3 and less costly for preparers to apply. And with that, I open the floor for discussion.
Mary?
I had a question about what's probably a second order issue in this analysis, which is what seems to be creeping in as an additional departure from IFRS 3. And that is about identifying who is the accounting acquirer. The paper, you know, identifies this as a possible issue, especially when NewCo is inserted. You know, I think you see it in Figure 3 on above paragraph 31. But it seems to say we're basically always going to follow. If I understood the paper correctly, it seems to say we're always going to follow the legal form of the transaction, unlike IFRS 3, in which you have to assess whether the legal acquirer is the accounting acquirer. And My understanding was that the difference we're looking at in this project for combinations under common control is predecessor, is the measurement basis. And I'm wondering why we're starting to pick and choose other aspects of IFRS 3, in terms of identifying who the acquirer is.
So let me try and answer this question if I understood it correctly. So in this population of transactions, first of all, we think using the logic in IFRS 3 for identifying the acquirer wouldn't really work, because in IFRS 3, and we argued that in the June paper, in IFRS 3, if in a situation where it's not obvious who the acquirer is, you're sort of looking through the combining entities and to the effect on the owners to identify which of the combining entities is an acquirer. But predecessor approach is only designed for transactions between wholly owned entities in the first place, and therefore applying the sort of logic in IFRS 3 to argue that a receiving entity for the accounting purposes must be different than a receiving entity for legal purposes doesn't seem to work. And secondly, I think we as staff generally look at the predecessor approach pretty much through the lens of combined financial statements. And because they're combined financial statements, the question of, well, which entity is the receiving entity is a little bit less relevant. I don't know if it's quite answers your question, Mary, though.
It kind of does, and it kind of raises another point that I think we have to be clear about in the consultation, which is the extent to which the common control transactions have a different accounting model for the transaction. Because if you say, it's really just, we have this population of BizCom under common control, and we're going to identify some that use a current value approach and some that use a predecessor method. It implies to me that otherwise IFRS, I don't know when we're departing from IFRS 3 and when we're not for other aspects of accounting for the transaction. So you've just said, and I don't think I've heard it before, that the staff is really viewing the predecessor method as based on combined financial statements. And I'm glad you didn't say pooling of interest. But it's more like combined financial statements, not actually acquisition accounting using predecessor basis. And I think we have to be clear about the extent of our departure from IFRS 3. Like, IFRS 3 sits there and isn't relevant at all to these transactions that are, within the scope, or pieces of IFRS 3 are only if we drag them in, or IFRS 3 is unless we say specifically that those pieces don't apply. And it just seemed to be kind of one or other pieces popping up as, the staff didn't think this piece was relevant, and I didn't remember the June discussion.
Well, I agree with the staff recommendation, largely because I would not support having the as-if concept having a role to play in the primary statements. I welcome pro forma in the note when time comes.
I also agree with the staff recommendation. Again, because it's sort of consistent with what we usually do and with our concepts, I don't like the idea of the sort of what-if type accounting. And also talking to some who apply the predecessor approach at the moment, where there's a requirement to combine from the beginning of the earliest period presented, even though they like predecessor method, they didn't like that requirement because in practice they found it difficult to do it, particularly on a timely basis. So I think there's practical considerations as well.
Okay.
Agree for the reasons that have been put forward, agree with the staff position. I just want to pick up on Mary's point about seeing which bits of IFRS 3 are coming in and not coming in. As I thought about this part, Mary, I thought of it as combined, that we were bringing together the accounting. So I was thinking about it that way. I wasn't thinking in terms of IFRS 3. I suppose because we'd gone into this area saying wholly owned, thinking about predecessor. So when I wanted to think what is prospective information or retrospective information could or should be provided. I did think about that as a combined entity. I didn't think acquisition accounting. So for my reading, I didn't see any buy-in from acquisition accounting in this area.
I didn't really object to it, but it just came as a bit of a surprise, as an assumption. But the other thing, I guess it's just, I'm wondering if we're being consistent in the sense that if you were really doing combined financial statements, I think you would combine them for all periods, not just from a transaction date. So I think we just have to think carefully about how we describe and characterize the model. And there's a lot that we rely on that's in IFRS 3 for answering questions about what do you do in this case, what do you do in that case, and make sure we've thought through the, you know, those issues.
And Mary, we take your point completely, and for further papers, we'll try to be clear on that. And just specifically with combined, I don't know if this comment is going to be helpful, but I suppose for me, my starting point in thinking about pre-combination information, because I view it as combined, I suppose, so my starting point was, as you just said, go back to the beginning of the earliest period presented. And when we consulted CMAQ and GPF and ASAP and put it on the table, we've had very different perspective, which we've taken on.
And I wasn't objecting to the staff recommendation. It was just, are we just codifying here's how to do it, or are we saying here's the model?
Chen Chao.
Just following up on the debate of the combining entities. I agree with the notion of combining entities, because whatever the receiving entity and the transfer entity, they already existed before the BCUC transaction, and also controlled by the controlling party before that date. And afterward, they still continue to exist. But what kind of, you know, approach or information or financial statement could faithfully represent or reflect this kind of continuation of those combined entities even before the BCUCC or afterwards? So with this regard, I prefer to require entity to provide pre-combination, you know, information, because otherwise it will be sometimes, because in this case, sometimes this, because BCUC sometimes it's very difficult to identify acquirer. Sometimes receiving entity may be much, much smaller than transferred entity. So if you don't require company to prepare the pre-combination financial data, so maybe before that, there is only the, so comparing period, only those financial statements of receiving entity available. After BCUC transaction, there is a sudden, you know, increasing of the asset, liability, revenue, and expenses, simply because you combine another, you know, entity. And those numbers are not comparable. I think it's very difficult for users to do trend analysis and to forecast the future cash flow or something like that. And also not reflect the, as I said, the continuation of the both businesses. I think it's different from regular business combination, because all the users and all the stakeholders are aware those business already existing and controlled by the controlling party before the BCC transaction. They just combine together, yeah. So, but once you combine together, you lost some part of the information, because you are not allowed the company to provide the pre-combination information. So a significant information was lost.
This is an excellent point, and like this is where we pretty much started in our analysis, and we specifically consulted on this point. We consulted with users, and they said, yes, this information is useful, but it needs to be included in the notes. We don't want any made-up numbers in the financial statements. We don't want any sort of picture of the group that did not exist in that shape over that period. So that feedback was pretty clear. But of course, we will collect further feedback in the consultation on the discussion paper.
Okay.
I don't think it's a made-up information. It's like so-called, as you said, that it's a pro forma information to give a whole picture of the combining businesses. Yeah. Anyway. Can I add one point? Because in some jurisdictions, if the company, they sometimes would go to IPO, and the regulator require them to provide maybe previous 3 years comparable information, and including those, you know, transferred entities information. So if under this kind of, you know, and this is the regulation, and I think, as I know, users also really want those information. They feel that that's information really helpful them, yeah.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
12 when absent.
Well, that brings us to the end of our discussions on UGC. This is also the last time, definitely, that Simone is at the table.
Yeah.
You were seconded from the OIC for about a year, I believe. OIC always sends very good people, and you are now accepted. Thank you very much for your very good work on BCUCC, and we wish you all the best back in Milan.
Yeah, thanks.
Where you're going to work for EY, I believe, right?
Yeah, going back to EY.
Bye. Success is not a bad place to be.
No, it's not. Yeah, thank you.